And also, if you would like to call in during the program here, call into the show, if you have a book to recommend, you can do that too. And that is this usual number, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our guests are Philip Graham and Tanya Leotsakis. Now, I think it's Tanya's turn.
It's my turn. I want to talk about The Life and Times of Michael Kay by J.M. Coetzee. Do I say it right? No one ever knows, do they?
Actually, he came here, and it's Coetzee.
Coetzee. Yeah, I thought there were three syllables, you know, you look it up online, it gives you one phonetic spelling.
I know.
Anyway, Coetzee. He's a pretty big writer. This is an old one that I hadn't read, and I've recommended a couple of other of his books on this program before. This one is about post-apartheid South Africa. And Michael Kay is a young man who has had a pretty hard life. He spent most of his life being a gardener. His mother was a housekeeper. And he finds himself in the middle of, you know, what's really a great deal of civil unrest in his country. And he needs to leave. His mother is very ill, and they're living under the stairs of the house of the people that she used to work for. And they have very little money, very little food, and he's just trying to make his way in the world, gardening and with the little money that they have. And they want to leave. And his mother wants to go to Prince Albert, which is an awful long way away, where there will be safety, she thinks, she hopes. And also it's where her family is from. And she just, before she dies, she just wants to go back there. He doesn't want her to die in this horrible war-torn city. So they apply for the papers to leave because, of course, all the borders are closed. No one can come in. No one can leave. And they wait and they wait and they wait. And no papers ever come. And he goes every day to the office and no one is able to help him. The papers never come. The mother says, just wait, they'll come. Just wait, they'll come. And finally, he sees the reality that there are no papers coming to allow them out of this country. And so he, like many others, decided to just take it upon himself to get he and his mother out. And he's a real simple man. He was born with a cleft palate and hasn't had a lot of social interaction. He's very shy and just very sweet. And he just has a simple kind of wisdom about him. That's very compelling. And he fashions a cart out of a wheelbarrow and wheels from his bicycle. He makes a cart with a canopy for his mother because she has poor circulation and she can't walk very far. And so he puts his mother in this cart, by God, and he wheels her out of that country. That's his plan. He's going to do it. He's going to walk her out. And he meets a lot of trouble along the way and a lot of soldiers and a lot of people prodding him for his papers. And he gets stopped lots of times and has to go back. But eventually his mom becomes very, very, very ill and he has to take her to the hospital. And he sleeps in the park overnight. And when he returns the next morning, they tell him, "We're sorry, we could not save your mother. And we cremated her, and here are her remains, and here are her clothes, and here's some soap for you, and a few things for you." The nurses were very kind to him. "And that's it. We're sorry. No mom." So he takes these ashes, and all the things they've given him that were hers, and he sets off, and he's going to go by himself, and he's going to get her ashes to Prince Albert, where they belong. And he just wants to go somewhere where he can be alone with nature and make a life and be safe and not have to worry about war. That's all he wants. And he finds himself in a work camp. Some soldiers stop him and coerce him into getting into the truck with a whole bunch of other people. And he ends up at this work camp where he makes a friend who's sort of very anti-establishment and has a lot of information for him and is able to tell him kind of more what's going on. And Michael Kay is simple. He's not stupid, but he's just simple, and he doesn't he didn't know about these things. He doesn't know about a lot of these things. And so here's what happens in the work camp, just as a sample of the amazing writing. This is Robert talking to Michael. "You want to know who this is?" murmured Robert. "This guy is the brother-in-law of the captain of police, Ustuizen. Pardon me for all of the South African proper names. Okay. I'm going to butcher them. His machine breaks down, so what happens? He picks up the phone, calls the police station, and first thing in the morning, he has 30 pairs of hands to cut his lucerne for him. That's how it works here, the system. They finished cutting the field in near darkness, leaving the baling for the next day. Kay was reeling with exhaustion. Sitting in the truck, he closed his eyes and felt as if he were hurtling through endless, empty space. Back in the hut, he fell into a dead sleep. Then, in the middle of the night, he was woken by the crying of a baby. There were discontented murmurs from around him. Everyone seemed to be awake. For what seemed hours, they lay and listened as the baby somewhere in the tents went through cycles of whimpering, wailing, and shrieks that left it gasping for breath. Aching to sleep, Kay felt anger mount inside himself. He lay with his fists clenched against his breast, wishing the child annihilated. In the back of the truck, with the slipstream roaring on them, Kay mentioned the crying in the night. "You want to know how they shut that child up in the end?" said Robert. "Brandy. Brandy and aspirin. That's the only medicine. No doctor in the camp. No nurse." He paused. "Let me tell you what happened when they opened the camp. When they opened the new home they had built for all the homeless people, the squatters from Bunchies Kraal and the Onderdorp, the beggars of the off the streets, the unemployed, the vagrants who sleep on the mountain, the people chased off the farms. Not a month after they opened the gates, everyone was sick. Dysentery, then measles, then flu, one on top of the other, from being shut up like animals in a cage. The district nurse came in, and do you know what she did? Ask anyone who was here, they'll tell you. She stood in the middle of the camp where everyone could see, and she cried. She looked at the children with the bones sticking out of their bodies, and she didn't know what to do. She just stood and cried. A big, strong woman, a district nurse. Anyway, said Robert, they got a big fright. After that, they started dropping pellets in the water and digging latrines and spraying for flies and bringing buckets of soup. But do you think they do it because they love us? Not a hope. They prefer it that we live because we look too terrible when we get sick and die. If we just grew thin and turned into paper and then into ash and floated away, they wouldn't give a stuff for us. They just don't want to get upset. They want to go to sleep feeling good.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, wow. Mm. So Michael goes a long way. He escapes from the camp. he sure does escape from the camp. And he ends up growing pumpkins and living on the side of the mountain.
I've read the book. She cannot hurt me.
Oh, all right.
Jane, oh, I thought you were worried about the public now. Ruining things for
no, it's
public.
All about me.
The horrible truth. The horrible truth comes out.
Anyway, war-torn South Africa, this amazing man and what he learns from nature and from having to survive.
Yeah. And Katsia, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yes.
Was for last year?
I think it was last year, right. Yeah.
Yeah, it was last year. Yeah,
2000. I think he's the only person who's won the Booker Prize twice. Or maybe, no, I think Peter Carey has also done that. Yeah,
I noticed you had a Peter Carey, and I've read him as well, but I haven't read this.
That's a great book. That's a great book. But I don't want to talk about that.
Okay, not yet. Okay,
I'll get to him. Yeah.
All right.
I want to, because it's kind of a change of pace in a way. This is a book of stories by a young writer named Adam Johnson called Emporium. And most of these stories take place in an America where things that are currently sort of going on in our culture now seem to have gone a step or two beyond. Things are terribly, terribly awry, but nobody seems to notice. And the story that I'd like to read from, as you'll see, it maybe says it all right here. It's the title of the story is Teen Sniper. When I reach the rooftop, I pull the dust covers off my rifle scope and head for a folding chair leaned up against an air conditioning unit, right where I left it the last time I was up here. Sitting down, I have a clear view across a courtyard of lawns and fountains to Hewlett-Packard. I line up a couple breakfast burritos on the parapet wall, in case this is a long one, and I crack a can of Nix. Most of us drink Nix because of how other sodas make you twitchy. I dial in my optics by focusing on flowers in the distance, impatiens and pansies mostly, and I'm tuning the rangefire when I get a go-ahead from Lieutenant Kim. Blackbird, Lieutenant Kim says over the radio, at your leisure, which is code for the fact that the hostage negotiations are failing and it's time to get to work. There's a tone in her voice, though, that kind of sounds like my mom when she gets on my case to join the private sector, where the real money is. I'll admit I sometimes daydream on the job, but I'm trying to better the community, so it's like, get off my back already. Now, this is a 15-year-old sniper working for the L.A. Police Department, and he's part of a team. Henry is huffing and puffing when he calls in. We've got a decent shot, he says, running out of breath. Probably 70%. He's working the foot pedals of the huge 20-millimeter Magnum while Cedric aims. Like me, Cedric and Henry came out of the target match circuit, with Cedric riding a full sniper scholarship to BYU and Henry touring Asia for Team Adidas. But Tuan is different. He's self-taught on the rooftops of Oakland, and like they say, the Lord looks out for left-handed snipers. Tuan's an Ayatollah with a rifle, completely composed. But he's touch and go as a police officer because he refuses to shoot women. Any of us could probably make the shot, but I don't want to look like a puss in front of the guys. Besides, not that I'm stuck up or anything, but I'm the one with the gift. I won the Disney Classic at age 11, scored a perfect 1,000 at the North Hollywood Open, and took gold in the summer snipe-thalon in Bonn, all before 13. I flip down my clip-on shades and take aim. Sometimes, when I look through my scope, I'm overwhelmed by the illusion that I know this stranger in the crosshairs in an essential way, like we're old friends, like you can see their soul. This effect is known as flash empathy. The LAPD has conducted a lot of field studies and found that flash empathy is a leftover from the reptilian part of our brain and can't be avoided. You've just got to turn a cold shoulder to it. Luckily, we have these new Raytheon scopes, which make it so you're not actually looking at the dude. It's just a video image. Sunglasses help.
Wow.
Crazy. So they're all about that
kind of future?
Yeah,
that kind of crazy future where things have gone morally terribly awry, but no one seems to notice.
Right.
All right. Well, Tanya, I guess you want to come back to you?
Sure.
Can I just say, the thing that's touching about that character is that he knows that he's doing something wrong, and the drama of the story is that he's slowly fighting against, in surreptitious ways, what the culture tells him. It's okay to be a sniper. You're helping out the community. And slowly but surely, he's kind of working his way, as a 15-year-old child would, who happens to be a sniper, kind of realize that he's been lied to in ways that he can't even give words to. It's an amazing story, amazing collection.
And the title of the collection is Emporium, Adam Johnson. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should mention, as I did in the first hour, that if you have access to the internet, we'll have the book list, the books that Philip and Tanya are recommending this morning, we'll have them on the website so that you can go there and you can get the titles. Or if you don't have internet access, if you'll give us a call or drop us a line, we'll print one up and we'll send it to you. Okay. Back to Tanya.
Okay. People are always accusing me of reading these horrible, sad, tragic things. What can I tell you?
Why would they say that?
That's what I like.
Because it's true?
It's just what I don't know why. I don't know why that stuff appeals to me. I guess it just, I just find it more thoughtful than happy stories all the time, I guess. I don't know. This is a book by Jodi Picoult, who I've recommended a lot of books by her. And she's a really good kind of, I call her my guilty pleasure, which isn't really fair to her because she's really a very capable writer. She's just maybe perhaps not as literary as a lot of the things that the other things that I read. But she's written a lot of very good books. And this one is the subject matter. Wow. It's called My Sister's Keeper. And it's about a 13-year-old girl who is suing her parents. And she's suing her parents for the rights to her body. And when she first approaches a lawyer about this, he says, oh, I don't do this kind of case anymore. I can't handle it. Let me give you the phone number of a good abortion clinic, blah, 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 blah. And she says, you clearly have no idea why I'm here. She's suing her parents for the right to her body because her sister, Kate, has leukemia, a very severe, rare form of leukemia. Mm-hmm. And she's had it since she was 2 years old, something like that. And her parents, Anna is her name, her parents decide to have another child in vitro. She's kind of one of these designer babies. They decide to have another child to get a genetic match for their daughter with leukemia so that they can use bone marrow and all kinds of different cells that they need and blood, of course. And eventually, by the time she's 13, a kidney. They're ready to take a kidney. And she and her sister are 3 years apart. She's 13. Her sister's 16. And they're very close. These aren't sisters who are fighting with each other all the time. They're very, very close. But she's beginning to feel, at this age of 13, that her body's really been taken away from her. By the time she's 13, she's had 9 surgeries. She's been poked and prodded and had blood and bone marrow and all of these things. And she's not sick. There's nothing wrong with the girl at all. But she says she might as well be sick because she has all of these procedures and she's treated as if, you know. And she also, of course, feels very ignored by her family. She also has a brother, Jesse, who you don't even realize until that there's another child involved. But he's not a genetic match. He's actually the oldest brother. He's not a genetic match, so he's not really an issue for the parents. I mean, they leave him alone. Boy, do they leave him alone. They really ignore him. The great thing about Jodi Picoult is that she gives you so many perspectives. She gives you the perspective of the mother, of the father, of the sister dying of cancer, of the sister suing for the rights to her own body, of this brother who's being ignored. And she does everybody first person. You really get everybody's dialogue. You get every... And so whatever you may think about the story initially, it's bound to change based on the emotions and the actions of the other people involved.
Altered by the access of intimacy you have with the other
characters. Altered by the access of intimacy you have, yes, exactly. And so she, and they're all great kids. The brother has some problems. He's an arsonist.
Okay.
Think he's trying to get any attention?
Probably not.
What's really, really interesting about this is that, okay, the father is a firefighter. The son is an arsonist. Right. The father is a firefighter,
right? There you go.
Okay. The father has never really been sure about having this baby for these purposes. He's never been totally on board with it. It's the mother that insisted upon this, the only way to save her daughter's life. And, you know, when you get her side of things, my God, what it's like to have a child that's dying. I mean... There's so much sympathy for everyone in this story, you know. But, you know, now they're going to take a kidney, and they're very pushy about it. And the father, one of the insights you get about the father and about him not being too sure about the whole deal is that he's the fire chief, and he has watched a lot of friends be hurt in fires and not come out of buildings and things like that. And he's talking about how he had to send his colleague into a building to save 2 children on the 3rd story of an apartment complex. And you wait a certain amount of time, you know, and they have their radios, but you wait a certain amount of time and then you've got to get them out of there. And his point is that in firefighting, the code is always, always that the safety of the rescuer must come before the safety of the victim. So if you apply that to his personal life, we've got a big, big problem here. I'm going to read just a little from it. They're actually asked to come on television because of the unusual nature of their daughter's conception or whatever. So they're going on television to try and defend themselves. And this is from Sarah, the mother. This is from her perspective. The camera comes to life with far less ceremony than I've expected, just a little hum that runs up my arms and legs. Mr. Fitzgerald, Nadia says, can you explain to us why you chose to visit a geneticist in the first place? Brian looks at me. Our 3-year-old daughter has a very aggressive form of leukemia. Her oncologist suggested we find a bone marrow donor, but our oldest son wasn't a genetic match. There's a national registry, of course, but by the time the right donor comes along for Kate, she might not be around. So we thought it might be a good idea to see if another sibling of Kate's matched up. A sibling, Nadia says, who doesn't exist. Not yet, Brian replies. What made you turn to a geneticist? Time constraints, I say bluntly. We couldn't keep having babies year after year until one was a match for Kate. The doctor was able to screen several embryos to see which one, if any, would be the ideal donor for Kate. We were lucky enough to have 1 out of 4, and it was implanted through IVF. Nadia looks down at her notes. You've received hate mail, haven't you? Brian nods. People seem to think that we're trying to make a designer baby. Aren't you? We didn't ask for a baby with blue eyes, or one that would grow to be 6 feet tall, or one that would have an IQ of 200. Sure, we asked for specific characteristics, but they're not anything anyone would ever consider to be model human traits. They're just Kate's traits. We don't want a super baby. We just want to save our daughter's life. I squeeze Brian's hand. God, I love him. Mrs. Fitzgerald, what will you tell this baby when she grows up? Nadia asks. With any luck, I say, I'll be able to tell her to stop bugging her sister. And then in the next... Yeah.
Man.
So then in the next segment, you get her going into labor with Anna. And you pick something up in this scene that is so disturbing. Because, you know, she's carried this child for 9 months, and the father sings to the belly every night, and all these warm, sweet things. And all along, she's really, really thinking about saving her existing daughter. So you see her have labor, and wow. She says some things that are shocking. So I'm just going to read that little part. I go into labor on New Year's Eve. The nurse taking care of me tries to distract me from my contractions by talking about the signs of the sun. This one, she's going to be a Capricorn, Imelda says as she rubs my shoulders. Is that good? Oh, Capricorns, they get the job done. Inhale, exhale. Good, two, no, I tell her. There are 2 other babies being born. One woman, Imelda says, has her legs crossed. She's trying to make it to 1991. The New Year's baby is entitled to packs of free diapers and a $100 savings bond from Citizens Bank for that distant college education. When Imelda goes out to the nurse's desk, leaving us alone, Brian reaches for my hand. You okay? I grimace my way through another contraction. I'd be better if this was over. He smiles at me. To a paramedic firefighter, a routine hospital delivery is something to shrug at. If my water had broke during a train wreck, or if I was laboring in the back of a taxi... I know what you're thinking, he interrupts, although I haven't said a word out loud. And you're wrong. He lifts my hand, kisses the knuckles. Suddenly, an anchor unspools inside me. The chain, thick as a fist, twists in my abdomen. Brian, I gasp, get the doctor. My OB comes in and holds his hand between my legs. He glances up at the clock. If you can hold on a minute, this kid's going to be born famous, he says. But I shake my head. Get it out, I tell him. Now. The doctor looks at Brian. Tax deduction, he guesses. I'm thinking of saving, but it has nothing to do with the IRS. The baby's head slips through the seal of my skin. The doctor's hand holds her, slides that gorgeous cord free of her neck, delivers her shoulder by shoulder. I struggle to my elbows to watch what's going on below. The umbilical cord, I remind him. Be careful. He cuts it, beautiful blood, and hurries it out of the room to a place where it will be cryogenically preserved until Kate is ready for it. Her love is for the umbilical cord.
Yeah, yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
The title of the book is...
Wow.
My Sister's Keeper.
All right. We're at the midpoint here, and, you know, I hate to follow that with something so crass as an appeal for money, but I must. This is one of the times during the year, and generally we just set aside 2 weeks a year here on the radio when we do something other than bring you the programs, where we try to remind you just how important your financial support is for this program to keep it going the way we do the rest of the year. Now, there are people who have supported us very generously and loyally year after year after year, and to them we say thanks. But to the other folks, the other out of those 10, the other 9 of the 10 people who listen who don't support the station, well, we want to say we need you. We need you now more than ever. We want you to go to the telephone and make a call, not to this program here, but to our Pledge Center. Make a call and make a financial pledge of support to the station. Simply pay a part of the cost of the programs that you enjoy. 244-9455 is the number. And our producer, our former producer, I guess I should say, Jack Brighton, now our man who is in charge of our web effort, he is in Pledge Central. And we would like to hear those phones ring. And as we have said during the first hour of the show, we're giving away books if people will call in with a pledge. Oh, hold on a second. There we just got to do it. Oh, there, okay, there we got you.
Right. The books, fiction or nonfiction, all you have to do is make a pledge call and tell the person who answers the telephone, in addition to the amount you'd like to pledge, that you would like a book, and specify either fiction or nonfiction. Again, the phone number 217-244-9455. But I wanted to say something about Focus 580 as somebody who has listened for a long time in addition to working here. I think everybody knows this. The show has intelligent interviews, amazing guests, practical topics, thought-provoking issues and perspectives. It's got balance, depth, and most of all, it's got David Inge, your host.
Isn't that sweet?
David has done more than 10,000 interviews over 20 years on this show. David Inge has done the work for all those interviews, preparing, researching, writing, thinking about the right questions. He just turned white. And then going on the air and doing 10,000 interviews. It's amazing his brain still works.
Oh, you think that it does.
Yeah, and yet he remains humble about it.
Lately,
thank you very much.
My brain has been not always present.
Well, 10,000 interviews, that's a lot. As his longtime producer, I'd like to claim credit for David Inge, but really the credit belongs to him. So go to your phones and support the show we call Focus 580, and David Inge, who's been here every day through war, peace, wet basements, you name it. 217-244-9455.
My amanuensis, ladies and gentlemen, Jack Brighton.
Yes.
Thank you, I guess. All I will say now for people who are listening is if you think this is a good show and you've enjoyed listening over the years, and if you are not a financial supporter of the station, please, for me, for whoever, make a pledge. It can be the $40 basic level. That'd be great. And you'll get patterns every month, and we'll send you a book. Or if you can make a more of a contribution, that would be great, too. I mean, that's up to you. But the thing that we keep focusing on is the fact that most of the people who listen to the station don't support it. It's 1 out of 10. And it's been as long as I've been in public radio, and that's been like 30 years now. It's been that way all that time. We think it would be great if we could get that to go from 1 in 10 to 2 in 10. Just bump it up by one. And if we did that and all of those people joined and just pledged at the basic membership level, that would be a lot of money. It would
Absolutely.
Be a very significant piece of change if we could do that. So, you know, everybody can't contribute, and we understand that. But if you can, if you can make a contribution, please do.
Yeah, David, and I want to mention
downloading radio.
Yeah. Well, we do have downloads on the website. That's another thing. We'll talk about some other time. But I wanted to say, one other thing, in addition to everything I said about David, of course, we also have to give a lot of credit to the producers, Harriet Williamson, who does an outstanding job both on Focus 580 and the Afternoon Magazine, and also Travis Stanzel, who also is a producer here on Focus 580. And they, you know, it's a group effort, so certainly David deserves a lot of credit, but I don't want to leave them out of the picture. This show is special, and of course, you as a listener, you're part of it. The listener part, the call-in part, and now we need you for the help pay the bills part, too. 217-244-9455. And do remember, we have this challenge going until noon. We're actually just about 5 calls short of meeting this challenge. A couple from Urbana will contribute $200 additional dollars if we hear from 25 people during this 2-hour period of Focus 580. We're 5 callers short of that, so help us make that challenge as well. 217-244-9455.
Thank you very much, Jack. We will check with you again at the end of the program. For people who are listening, we're doing one of our regular kind of book shows here with Philip Graham and Tanya Latsakis. Philip teaches at U of I. He's in the English department. Tanya works at Pages for All Ages Bookstore. And they love books. And every once in a while here on the show, they bring new things that they have discovered, things that they have been reading lately they think you will enjoy, and they talk about them. And if you are listening out there in Radio Land and there is a book that you would like to recommend, You may do that, too, by calling our regular number, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And, of course, we hope that people will call in and make a pledge. I think now back to it is Philip's turn.
Yes,
now.
I'd like to recommend more short stories, these by a master of the strange and peculiar and bizarre and strange and oddly normal, Kelly Link, and her story collection, Stranger Things Happen.
I'm going to love this. I can tell already.
And she writes pretty amazing stories. She's got the first story starts off with one of the most peculiar stories about someone existing in the afterlife that I've ever read. And then there's a really terrifying story about two girls in a strange mystical hat, and another story about the Greek gods secretly living among the contemporary English, and forth. Yeah, she just does things that you'd never expect. And the story that I'm going to read from is called Louise's Ghost, and there's a wonderful ambiguity here because the two main characters in the story are both called Louise, which causes for some trouble a little here and there in dialogue when Louise and Louise are talking, but that's part of the charm of the story. And one of the Louises has a daughter, and she works, I think, as a publicist for a symphony, and she's having kind of consecutive affairs with all the cellists in the symphony. And the other Louise is a woman who has a ghost in her house, a ghost who I think she first finds him dangling upside down in her closet, and he hangs out beneath her bed, and he's sort of oddly substantial and insubstantial, and she doesn't know what to do with him. And so she's asking for advice from the other Louise, who is a woman who she's secretly attracted to. And she's talking to her right now. And the first Louise who has the daughter says, "How's your ghost?" Louise says. "Louise has a ghost," she tells Patrick, who's with them at the time. "Smaller," Louise says. "Hairier." Louise doesn't really like Patrick. He's in love with Louise, for one thing. It embarrasses Louise, the hopeless way he looks at Louise. He probably writes love songs for her. He's friendly with her daughter Anna, as if that will get him anywhere. "You tried garlic?" Louise says. "Spitting? Holy water? The library?" "Yes," Louise says, lying. "How about country music?" Patrick says. "Johnny Cash, Patsy Cline, Hank Williams." "Country music," Louise says. "Is that like holy water?" "I read something about it," Patrick says, "in New Scientist or Guitar Magazine, or maybe it was Martha Stewart Living. It was something about the pitch, the frequencies. Yodeling is supposed to be effective." Makes sense when you think about it. So Louise takes that into account because the ghost is bigger again. He's prickly all over. He bristles with hair. The hair is reddish-brown and sharp-looking. Louise doesn't think it would be a good idea to touch the ghost now. All night he moves back and forth in front of her bed, sliding on his belly like a snake. His fingers dig into the floorboards, and he pushes himself forward with his toes. His mouth stays open as if he's eating air. Louise goes to the kitchen. She opens a can of beans, a can of pears, hearts of palm. She puts the different things on a plate and places the plate in front of the ghost. He moves around it. Maybe he's like Anna, picky. Louise doesn't know what he wants. Louise refuses to sleep in the living room again. It's her bedroom, after all. She lies awake and listens to the ghost press himself against her clean floor, moving backwards and forwards before the foot of the bed all night long. In the morning, the ghost is in the closet, upside down against the wall. Enough, she thinks, and she goes to the mall and buys a stack of CDs. Patsy Cline, Emmylou Harris, Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, Lyle Lovett. She asks the clerk if he can recommend anything with yodeling in it, but he's young and not very helpful. "Never mind," she says, "I'll just take these." While he's running her credit card, she says, "Wait, have you ever seen a ghost?" "None of your business, lady," he says, "but if I had, I'd make it show me where it's buried its treasure. And then I'd dig up the treasure, and I'd be rich. And then I wouldn't be selling you this stupid country music. Unless the treasure has a curse on it." "What if there wasn't any treasure?" Louise says. "Then I'd stick the ghost in a bottle and sell it to a museum," the kid says. "A real live ghost, that's got to be worth something. I'd buy a hog and ride it to California. I'd go make my own music, and there wouldn't be any yodeling." The ghost seems to like Patsy Cline. It isn't that he says anything, but he doesn't disappear. He comes out of the closet. He lies on the floor so that Louise has to walk around him. He's thicker now, more solid. Maybe he was a Patsy Cline fan when he was alive. The hair stands up all over his body, and it moves gently, as if a breeze is blowing through it. They both like Johnny Cash. Louise is pleased. They have something in common now. "I'm on to Jackson," Louise sings. "You big-talkin' man."
Now, in all fairness to Emmylou Harris, she may live in Nashville, but she is not country.
Yeah.
Well, particularly her, some of her recent work is very odd and interesting and greatly appealing. So
alt-country, I think they call
alt-country,
it.
Alt-country, yeah. Is that what they're calling it.
And
yeah.
She is one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen
indeed,
in my life.
So,
And ghosts like her. You know,
and ghosts like
and
him.
Who can blame them?
Now, besides the book Stranger Things Happened by Kelly Lynch, she's also the editor of an anthology called Trampoline, which I also highly recommend. And there, I must say, the stories are very kind of Kelly Lynch-ish. And I'll just read a couple of the titles of some of the stories to give you a sense of what you're in for if you read this book. Insect Dreams by Rosalind Palermo Stevenson. Vandana Singh's The Woman Who Thought She Was a Planet. Maureen McHugh's Eight-Legged Story. Alex Irvine's Gus Dreams of Biting the Mailman. And Ed Park's Well Moistened with Cheap Wine, The Sailor and the Wayfarer Sing of Their Absent Sweethearts. And these are also very strange and unusual and odd stories, and they're all extremely crisply well-written. Very good anthology. Trampoline.
And Trampoline. And the author of the last story was the editor of this collection.
Kelly Link. Yeah, Stranger Things Happen is a collection of all of her own stories. Right. Kelly Link, and she's also the editor of this anthology of stories, Trampoline.
All right, very good. Well, we have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. If somebody wanted to get in a call real quick, we could do that. Otherwise, we'll just keep on going and give next turn to Tanya.
I feel like I should mention this Lois Lowry book. Lois Lowry is a young adult writer. Oh, well, she writes for all kinds of ages, but primarily young adult. And she wrote The Giver, which is, I mean, everyone has to read The Giver in school now. The Giver is
an
incredible novel. And also Gathering Blue, which is another novel of hers that I've recommended on the program. And these two books are both set in future societies, but to my knowledge had not a thing to do with one another.
Hmm.
Not one darn thing. Different characters, different plot, different time period, the whole thing. Just had nothing, just two separate standalone novels by Lois Lowry. Well, her newest book is called The Messenger. And apparently, those two books have everything in the world to do with one another.
Oh, I love it. That's great.
And I can't tell you a lot about it because I haven't read very much of it, but I'm just fascinated that she is going to tie these two books together in this one. We have another future society. Characters from both of those novels appear here.
Oh, man.
I really like that idea. And she's just a phenomenal writer and always talks about the future and what may happen. And it's all very sort of Orwellian. And this one is going to be just the same way. But I felt like I should mention it because it's her new one and everyone loves her. Mm. And it ties these two books together that I had no idea were alike.
And this is, it's billed as young adult.
Young adult, fiction, yes.
Fiction. Mm-hmm. But of course, you're not going to ask for your ID.
I do wish that more adults would read young adult novels because there's a lot there. I mean, there's a lot of great writing in the world of young adult stuff. And I've said before that I think it takes a lot of talent to be a good writer in the first place and then to put it through this kind of filter that you have to put it through to make it for young adults. It's a very specific kind of talent. And there's a lot of amazing books, I think, that people miss because, you know, they're not looking for children's books.
Well, it seems to be one of those categories that has grown. In fact, when I was a kid, I don't think that there
you didn't
was
have
such a thing.
Young adult.
There were children's books.
That's right.
There were adult books.
Yeah.
There didn't seem to, now maybe those books there were books that existed in that category, but I don't remember it. I just remember going from the kids section to to the adult section,
adult novels,
whatever it is that I could manage to make my way through.
Marketing person invented it, probably.
So I felt like I should mention that, and I also, just real quickly, another young adult novel, which I don't have with me because I've loaned it out, and it comes out in May, and it's called Luna, and it is special because it's by Julie Peterson, and Luna, L-U-N-A, like the moon, and it's special and unique because it is... To my knowledge, as you both know, I have a fascination with studying and learning about and understanding gender identity and transsexual experience and things like that. And this is the first novel that I've ever known about for young adults, which addresses that issue. And it's about a young man, a transgendered young man. He's about 13. So I felt like I should mention that, too, because no one's ever done that before.
All right.
Good to do.
All right. Philip, you want to take
I think, we've been doing mainly fiction. I have a book that I've just adored reading. It's called The Traveler's Guide to Mars. And it's written, I mean, there's a lot of photographs in here, so maybe this is, you know, completely ridiculous to be recommending it over the radio. But it's written, and in fact, the shape and format of this book is like, I think, isn't it Dorling Kindersley?
Those, DK, yeah.
Yeah, DK. Mm-hmm. It's like the DK tourist books.
It looks like Dorling Kindersley, yeah, but it isn't.
It's a traveler's guide to Mars, as if you are going around looking at the various parts of Mars, and they show the planet, and they have a little square where the space that they're taking a look at is located on the planet, and they're mainly using photographs from the Mars Observer and Global Surveyor mission, and they're wonderful photographs, and they you see things that you never knew were on Mars. I mean, what a complicated place it is geographically. One place I like to talk about is a place called Promethe Terra, where the mountain ranges in this part of Mars seem to be melting. You look at the pictures, and this is the first one, which is very high up, and you see this kind of, well, it just looks like there's a bunch of stuff that seemed to have melted off the side of the planet. And then, of course, what happens when the Global Surveyor, Mars Global Surveyor, sees something interesting is they start concentrating on it. So the next picture is a close-up of that, and you can definitely see there's been some kind of land fill, or some, not land fill, but some kind of land that's come off the mountain ridge. And then there's an even closer one, and when you look at that, you see in fact that it's a glacier, and you see the striations of movement, and in fact this is a glacier that's come off the mountain, that there was in fact ice, therefore water, on top of this mountain, and then there was a period where it warmed up, and so the glacier, the ice came down off the side of the mountain, and you begin to see how incredibly complex, and all of the different sections of this book, how complex geologically the planet Mars is. It's really endlessly fascinating, and you know, and written, the format and everything, almost as if it was a kind of a tourist guide. You know, the only problem I have with it is they give no names of good restaurants or hotels. So if you do go, you're on your own with that.
Pack a lunch.
Yeah, and it's called The Traveler's Guide to Mars, The Mysterious Landscapes of the Red Planet, and it's written by William K. Hartman, who's the first winner of the Carl Sagan Medal from the American Astronomical Society and a participating scientist in the U.S. Mars Global Surveyor mission. Yeah. It's a wonderful read.
It seems like lately we're getting a lot of stuff about Mars, and maybe it's because of the recent missions there, there's a lot of interest, or also because of the fact that recently Mars came closer to the Earth than in a long, long time, and so we got a really nice view. It was very, very dramatic, and people seem to be jazzed about it. And, well, I guess they sort of always have been.
Yeah. About Mars.
About Mars.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it has gotten people's imagination going. And
it's the closest planet in terms of what we assume a planet is like from our own experience on Earth as there is in the solar system, you know, as different as it is.
So beautiful from a telescope, beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went out the night it was the closest. Yeah. The whole family went out, and we got a really fabulous look through it. Some telescopes that everybody had set up in one of the parks. Yeah.
Nice.
Okay. Well, we still have some more time.
Let me just say about this book, Awake, it's a novel by Elizabeth Graver, who wrote The Honey Thief, which was pretty popular there among reading groups for a while, which was a really good one. This is a very interesting idea for a novel. It's about a couple who, they have a lovely, happy marriage, and they have a child and everything's good, but the second child that's born has a problem. The second child that's born has a light sensitivity disorder, and he's not able to be in the light. It's really damaging to him. And so
he's an albino.
He's not an albino. Hmm. This is, and apparently this is a real thing, this light sensitivity thing. He's just, he's unable to be in the sunshine. And so they take him to a camp for people, children and adults, with this disorder. And the camp is called, of all things, I just talked about this book, Luna. The camp is called Camp Luna. Again, because of the darkness and whatever. So the book is about the family going to stay at this camp with him, where everyone sleeps in the daytime and does all of their living and being awake at night. And they have night-blooming flowers there, and everything takes place at night. The problem with it is that this couple has the other child, who does not have this problem. So the parents have to sort of split their responsibilities between day and night, and I'm going to go and stay with this child. And so the marriage kind of... But what an interesting idea about this. I didn't even know it existed, but apparently it's a real thing.
That's one of the... You know, I'm thinking about... Someone said... about why it is he read, he said something like, well, you know, I'm only going to be able to meet so many people in my lifetime. And by reading, what I can do is get to know and get into the heads of
people you will never have an opportunity to meet.
That's, you know, sometimes people have said, well, why do you want to read these strange stories? Yeah. And obviously
because
the reason...
it's life enriching.
It's life enriching, yes.
You know? But how else could you possibly... You know, imagine
discover
what it would be like,
to
be somebody, to be in that person's life who is completely in every possible way you can imagine of different from yours.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and that's the this is the only way that you're gonna be able to
do it.
Right.
Fiction.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
I stand by my genre.
It's a good thing. Well, I want to say to both of you very much, thank you, Philip and Tanya, for being here.
Thanks for having us.
We'll not wait such a long time until the next. Maybe one of these days pretty soon we're going to have to talk about summer reading, I guess.
Oh, yes.
Sounds good. We can do that.
The list of the books that we have discussed, and there may be some others that we didn't even get to, will be on our website, will.uiuc.edu. And if you do not have internet access, if you will call us or drop us a line, we'll send you a copy of the book list. And then you can go out there to the bookstore or to the library or wherever you go to get your reading material, and you can scoop some of these things up.